Welcome once again to Deep Fat Fried. How's everybody doing tonight? All righty.
Feeling pretty fucking hyped,
you're
TJ.
You're feeling hyped, Paul. Yeah. All right.
High energy tonight, TJ. I like that. Higher energy.
Triple hop, TJ,
nah.
We got tonight.
Yeah, that's it. That's
we got
all
TJ.
Got.
We got triple hop,
higher
TJ.
Energy tonight,
no, I'm
TJ.
Out of energy
hop,
now.
Pop, pop, pop. Pop, pop, pop.
Shut up.
Pop, pop, pop.
No.
All right.
Shut up, Paul.
Hey, I got my driver's license today.
Woo!
Isn't that cool?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I saw it. You actually look pretty good in the picture.
Yeah, it's crazy. It's easily the best I've ever looked on a driver's license
photo. I think
it's
the best I've ever seen you look in any context.
Wow.
Wow.
I'll take that compliment.
It is, you know, because you actually look, because most people, their driver's license photo is one of the worst photos of them. You managed to pull off a really nice, friendly looking goddamn. Mine's terrible.
Look, I haven't really looked at it. I don't really look
at it. Yeah, I don't think I've ever seen yours, Scotty. You probably shouldn't show it on, you know.
Yeah, don't show it on the camera because it's got all kinds of.
Oh, yeah, that doesn't even really look like Scotty.
I know,
anymore.
Dude.
Let me see it.
That looks like the Sprock Scotty.
Dude, yeah.
What about yours, TJ?
I don't even know what the fuck's going on.
I don't even know. What the fuck is your hair in this?
I don't know, dude.
You look like Vanilla Ice, but yeah. Like you let your hair grow out a few days.
Well,
or
I'll redact the rest of the information and put it out.
Yeah, we should all take.
We can all just like put out the picture part. Here,
yeah,
I'll show you.
Yeah,
mine.
Dude.
Yeah, I want to see yours.
Let's see TJ's real fast.
Yeah, we can cut some pictures up and throw them to Taylor to throw into this video maybe later.
I just look like a fucking sad fish.
Let me look. Dude, I gotta see.
You do, dude. You look like a sad fish. No, dude, right?
Dude, what was wrong? I guess I don't need to ask. You were
DMV,
at the DMV,
you know,
yeah.
So. Oh, yeah. Dude, this is, you know what? Because, like, I remember this visit. Like, me and TJ went at the same time to try to get, like, try to get his registration sorted out or some shit.
Yeah.
And they just gave us this litany of shit we had to do. It's like, so you got to go here and talk to this. And it's like, it was just more of the runaround. It's like,
gotta
I don't know
go
what it's
here and gotta do
it's
this.
Just that typical government bureaucracy bullshit where it's like, you just get the runaround. You need to talk to this person. You talk to that person. What are you talking about? Then you need to talk to this person.
Then you talk to this person here about this thing here.
Yeah.
So that's the face you had, basically.
Yeah, it's good stuff, huh?
The sad face of an abused man.
Well, also, I mean, she had to sit there for 3 fucking hours.
Oh, I feel your fucking pain. I got to the DMV at 7:30 in the morning.
Ooh.
There were already 20 people in line in front of me, and they opened at 8. And I got everything taken care of. I was out of there by 10:30.
Yep, sounds about right. And that's because you went right when it fucking opened,
right.
Dude.
Dude, I tried to go on Friday. This past Friday, and I got there at like, I don't know, 11 in the morning or some shit. Dude, the number up on the screen, right, was when I got there, it was like 79 or something.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I pulled 74, which means that the fucking numbers had to cycle all the way through to 99, then back around to 1, 2, 3, up to my 74. I sat there for an hour and I was like, fuck this. I'm coming back on Monday, first thing in the morning.
Dude, I do not blame you.
There is no way. When I left, it was pushing 2 when I left over there, like 1:30, and they close at 4. I was like, dude, and they were on like, they weren't even on 1 or 2 yet when I left. They were still on 99. I was like, no, there's no way this is getting done.
You would have left at 5 o'clock, 5:30.
They would have closed. They close at 5.
If you have a number before, they will serve you.
Oh, will they?
You basically would have been there for 5 hours to get that done.
Yeah, I see. Fuck that.
Hell no.
2.5. 2.5, baby.
Well,
got it done.
I'll tell you what, like in Washington State when I got a license, it was nothing. It was like 5 fucking minutes. In California, they have appointments.
Oh,
which makes total fucking sense. I'm like, that's like the most brilliant thing
a lot
about
of
that
states
state.
Have done that,
yeah.
Where you can book an appointment online and just show
it
up at
so
a certain time.
It's so much fucking faster, dude. It's you go in there, it's like 2 seconds. Like even if it's 3 weeks later to get the appointment.
Not here
so.
In Louisiana, though.
Yeah, that's pretty crazy shit. Now, you guys might have heard, we've announced it here on this channel, that we have been demonetized as a
mm-hmm.
channel.
Woo!
Kyle Kalinske over at Secular Talk has talked about our demonetization. Even Jimmy Dore has talked about this channel's ridiculous demonetization.
I gotta say, not to do too much of an aside, but I've watched a little bit of Jimmy Dore. He's all right, I guess.
I told you. I mean, like, he's all
right. I'd still think he needs to atone for the spitting viper, but he's not a total dunderhead.
I mean, sometimes he puts out something that's actually decent. But you know what?
He does.
whether you like him or not, he did talk about the fact that our channel's demonetized, which we do appreciate because spreading awareness of that, I hope it helps.
DFF, loved by thousands, hated by millions.
Exactly. And I don't know. And we were demonetized for the stupidest fucking reason, because somehow our show is hate speech or some nonsense, which it's not.
Utter absurdity.
Well, I mean, I thought it is. I mean, I thought that.
I mean we hate
guys,
TJ.
We hate, yeah, I mean, everyone,
hate each
I thought
other.
We had
we
that
all
secret
hate each other.
Cabal meeting where we're like, this is a hate speech
it's
to
like,
show.
I mean,
remember that? Like, Paul's all like, I want to just be racist, and you're like, no, I just want to be.
Before
I want to be a bigot.
And like before the show, like, you know, all three of us, we come here, we don't speak to each other, we don't say anything unless we absolutely have to,
right?
Because I mean, like behind the scenes, we absolutely revile each other, obviously,
yeah. And pretty openly on the show too, honestly.
Yeah, I mean,
so maybe,
you know,
that's the hate speech.
But
we kind
of have
for.
To pretend that we kind of can somewhat.
I like you,
Paul. We're all just joking, but in reality,
you're a great guy,
it's like,
Paul.
Don't touch me.
Oh, I'm sorry.
It's like, you know, fuck Paul. He's disgusting. Scotty obviously is a piece of shit.
Yeah, okay.
You know,
Paul.
And all of us are obviously horrible people and all that stuff. But, you know, at the end of the day, though, we were not doing hate speech.
Maybe you are, TJ.
There was no, you're a fucking terrible person. There was no hate speech. There was no bigotry.
Never.
You know, we hate all peoples of the world.
We're misanthropes.
Equal fervor.
We hate all people.
We do
equally.
Not discriminate
and ourselves.
Any group.
And ourselves, most of all.
I do not believe.
Oh, definitely ourselves, most of all.
Maybe that's what they're talking about. We hate ourselves too much.
Well, I don't hate myself, but I hate both of you.
Yes,
so,
you do.
You know,
you hate yourself.
Oh, you hate yourself.
Some
dude.
Part of me maybe.
You have
hates
a deep.
Myself.
A deep
go in the mirror right now and
talk.
It must be pretty repressed.
Get a fucking mirror, and I want you to look in a fucking mirror and be like, I love you.
We're
TJ.
Getting off track, though. The point is, our channel has been fucking demonetized, so we figure, why not monetize the demonetization? And we've had an artist work on a fucking design for us. We don't have a whole lot of shirts here on this show. We haven't traditionally yet, but here's one.
She approaches from a place in the cosmos that no eye has ever seen. Wojcicapus. The Wojcicapus. And only three neckbeards can destroy her. And you see them depicted here. Paul in his battle ball. Scotty throwing his laser beam, and TJ preparing to bring down the dildo axe.
And this shirt, by the way, was directed by J.J. Abrams, which
yes.
is why you see all the lens
yes.
flares.
Of course.
Directed by J.J. Abrams.
We only get the best here at
Deep
Fat Fried.
Drawn by the very talented Spooky Lolly, yes. Who I think that's how you find Spooky Lolly on Twitter, but we will put Spooky Lolly's Twitter down in the description.
Down motherfucking below, because he's
very
a good
talented
artist.
Guy.
But he drew this for us, and this is us battling the
Wojcicapus.
Hey, a good thing
we
about
have been
this though.
Demon.
A good thing about this, TJ, is less annoying ads for you guys and more insane T-shirts.
Yes, more shirts, less ads. So it's available in many, many colors. Here's
this shirt is
this
badass.
Is the store right here. You could go here and buy it. We'll take a look at some of the colors. You can get it in green.
I think the green looks pretty dope.
Looks kind of Joker-y almost. That's kind of cool because the border.
Good
fucking
primary colors and stuff.
I think in our Patreon.
Get it,
the classic black is what I think
black.
I'm going to go for.
We didn't talk about this, but I think we'll probably, because we said this is one of our perks for patrons, we'll probably throw in a promo code for you guys.
Yeah, we'll work
for
on
patrons.
A promo code for patrons.
You got it here in blue. You got it in light blue.
I like that light blue
white.
One, too. That clean white.
This purple one actually looks really cool.
Well, that's just pink on pink, TJ.
Yeah, pink on pink. Two on to pink, one
so
on
so there's
sink.
Some pretty cool colors, a really cool design.
Yeah, I think probably my favorite is this light blue, actually.
I like that light blue. Oh, I really do.
I know we're all going to get one, so we'll have to pick
different
ones or something.
Check it out. It's going to be fucking awesome. You can buy that down below. It's available now. Help support this fucking terrible goddamn show and get us more drugs and hookers and whatever else.
And ice cream, of course.
Oh, yeah, you got to get the ice cream, especially the ice cream. Anyway, that's that.
So I was led to believe there was going to be an episode. I know, Paul, you said you were doing this episode.
Yeah.
I think you kind of had kind of the conversation. You're like, fuck this shit. TJ's a f***ing, why bother? So, I mean,
oh,
sorry.
You just dropped. Now you.
God damn it, Scotty.
Oh, now TJ's got to go and
now
fucking edit the show.
Oh, that's on Taylor at this point. She got to edit
all right.
that now.
Damn. Sorry, Taylor.
Damn.
It just happens once a show.
I'll never bleep me.
Bleep. Well, that's what I did. I just went and bleeped it.
Taylor, just bleep me.
Bleep the F word. We can't say that no more.
The fuck word?
No, that's not the bad. That's not the that's bad not the F word anymore.
Oh, I'm glad that's not a bad word. At least I'm happy.
You can say fuck to your fucking heart's content.
All right, cool.
Just don't say the F maggot word.
Yes, Bad word. Yep. You know what? You're right.
Even though you're sandwiched in between two bisexuals, you can't use that
word.
You're
right. I'm so terrible. Because
you're fucking. I obviously hate you, bigot, dude.
Yes. Totally correct.
Without further ado, gentlemen.
Yeah.
You know, every business creates garbage. And every businessman has to take out the trash. It's usually considered to be a lowly job, best delegated to an unskilled underling, a new hire, someone whom you don't trust with much responsibility. Of course, some kind of garbage needs special care. A skilled hand, a deft touch, a disingenuous smile, a strong stomach, a cold demeanor, a prodigious strength, and utmost discretion. Some trash, if allowed to fester, begins to stink so badly that everyone can smell it. And that, my friends, that is bad for business. In the early part of the 20th century, in New York City, a special kind of waste disposal team was needed. The garbage was reeking. Business was suffering. And only the most skilled garbage men were up to the task. The air needed cleaning. The refuse needed disappearing. Murder Incorporated were just the men for that job. What do you think about that, huh?
Bravo!
Bravo, son!
What about that? I wrote that myself, guys.
It was very prodigious, prodigious. I know.
I fucking stumbled
you
once.
You fucked it up. You fucked it up, Paul.
Man, I stumbled once.
Hey,
it sucked.
Paul.
But whatever. The rest
ruined
of it was
the
pretty
whole
goddamn good.
Fucking performance.
Paulie,
Paul.
You fucked it up, Paulie.
What do you want me to
I thought you were. I thought you were gonna go with the more traditional, like, see?
Oh, God, no. I couldn't have maintained that through three
paragraphs.
You're
going to watch it yourself, Tina. Paul might go Goodfellas on your shit. You fucking start. You taunt him too many times, dude. Get up
so,
in a hole.
You're taunting me, eh?
There's a book that if you're interested about what we're going to cover tonight, I can't recommend highly enough. It's called Murder, Inc. by Christian Cipollini. I picked it up on Amazon, and it's pretty cheap. It's like $10. I didn't read it cover to cover, but I read quite a bit of it for prep for tonight's show.
Cool.
And what I really appreciated about it was it didn't demonize these guys beyond frank descriptions of what they did. It wasn't looking to moralize overly.
I hate that shit when they do that.
Right. It was implicit that what these guys did was horrible, and he didn't need to pile on the melodrama.
I think it's fucking shitty writing when they fucking feel the need. It's like, I mean, like, you know, you just tell me what the fuck happened. I'll pronounce my own moral bullshit over it if I want to.
Yep. So, and I was particularly impressed with his intro, and it's really a good intro to, I think, what could be a conversation between us here at the beginning of this.
Cool.
So I'll read a little bit of it here.
Sweet.
The very first point to be made is this.
And what's the name of this book?
This book is called Murder, Inc., Gangland Mysteries, and it's by Christian Cipollini. So the very first point to be made is this. The mob was not designed, created, organized, nor operated for the purpose of killing. The mob served one purpose, to make money, illicit or illegitimate, hand over fist. That's it. So ends the first lesson in organized crime economics. The mob existed to make money. And this is an interesting point to make because so much of what you see, even in really good mob movies, it seems that most of what they do
is just murder each other.
Is murder one another.
Yeah. Which, I mean, it definitely is a part of their business, but it's an essential part of their business, but it's also not, I mean, like, look, everyone knows
look,
if
you
it's constant
are,
mayhem, I mean, it's, look at the movie like The Godfather, where it's like, yeah, these things have to happen every once in a while. That's kind of the mentality is like, when they, if you talk about that, it's like, even in those movies, I think they're still, it's still accurately depicted to some degree where it's like, look, this doesn't happen all the time, but murder is definitely, and violence is part of it.
But if you're making your money illegally, right? And you obviously, if someone fucks you over or someone's doing something that normally you'd involve the authorities with or whatever,
mm-hmm.
You know, you don't have that. You can't turn to law enforcement.
Well, this is true.
To right wrongs or anything. You need your own fucking system of enforcement. And by necessity, it has to be a more brutal system.
It's basically black market self-regulation. Is
right.
What I'm trying to say.
So, I mean, like, really, the murders is part of a regulatory body that's
right.
overseeing this whole thing.
And Christian Cipollini backs you up here. He says, the division of gangster brethren this work engages in, the infamously dubbed Murder Incorporated, was not formed much differently than any department of legitimate corporate business. Just like legally operating corporate America, the mob had accounts payable, accounts receivable, public relations, security, a hierarchy of management, logistics, you name it. They employed people or entire crews to handle such industry requirements. However, the mob also had an enforcement arm, a self-policing unit of cold-blooded hoods working exclusively under contract for specific upper management entities. Their duty? To keep the business of making money on a smooth road, free of human obstacles that could jeopardize profit-making. In the psyche of gangland minds, well, it was all a matter of basic economics. Instilling that fear and carrying out that promise of reprisal was a basic requirement for criminal operations to ensure rules were followed, monetary gain commenced, and bosses would be protected.
Yeah, and I mean, like, a lot of people, especially, like, you see a lot of racists today, they're like, oh, black crime, statistics, black crime. Well, it's because there's a lot of this fucking, I mean, it's not, like, the same as this mob, obviously.
Right.
But, you know, it's when you run illegitimate businesses, the only way to enforce rules is with brutality and violence, because you can't turn to law enforcement, you can't build a prison.
Right.
You can't fucking, you know, say, oh, well, we're going to deal with this in a peaceful way. I mean, and obviously a lot of times they did try to use diplomatic solutions when possible. And I'm not saying that these guys had no choice but to do this. They could have.
But when you decide on that course of action,
obviously,
the cheapest, easiest, and most definitive way is to kill the person.
Right? Well, in fact, as we go on tonight, you'll find that it was far from these guys had no choice but to do this.
Right. Obviously, they wanted. Look, they decided that the most important thing to them was profit and
exactly.
the fucking luxurious lifestyle. So they had a choice in that regard. But once they decided to be organized criminals, then it becomes not a matter of choice, because if you don't kill,
right,
you will
if
be
you
killed.
Have a problem with violence, you're either going to be killed yourself, or which is probably still going to happen anyway, or you know you're just not going to be successful at it, because if you don't
right.
have any means of enforcing your will, then no one's going to follow it, and you're not going to be effective as a boss or as any sort of underling, even as a you know for a crime syndicate, organized crime enterprise,
yeah,
whatever.
You have to have no problem with violence and actively encourage violence as a way of enforcing that hierarchy.
So
right.
I've got a little bit more of this, but I wanted to start with like a question before I moved on with the next little quote from Cipollini here.
Sure.
And that is, can you guys, let's brainstorm some ways you think you could cross the mob if you were involved with them in some way,
right.
whether that's a member of the mob or part of their protection racket, right?
Right.
What are some ways that you can think of off the top of your head
that
you think would get you clipped?
Skimming off the top.
Oh, yeah, that's number one. Skim.
So taking money, right? Stealing
it's
from the mob.
It's all about profit, so yeah.
Right.
Right.
Interfering with their ability to make that profit. So,
sure.
like, you know, if they have a scam and you know, the scam gets broken
if you
up
and
something you did.
If you and some other people get fucking pinched or whatever,
oh, yeah.
you
caught,
know, and you fucking sing.
Rat.
You know?
Yeah, that's a
ratting
big one.
Out your fucking contemporaries. That's obviously a big
just pissing your
no-no.
Boss off. Pissing up the higher-ups.
Yeah,
like,
not
you know,
showing proper respect.
Not obeying orders.
Yeah, disobeying
for
orders
sure.
for
or,
any reason.
Or
really.
Fucking up a direct order. So really... Really
yeah, or
badly.
Yeah, incompetence.
Right.
Yeah.
So Cipollini talks about it a little bit here. He says, how does one go about jeopardizing the mob's profits? Many ways, actually. But the primary reasons to be paid a visit by the enforcement arm would include muscling in on another's territory.
Didn't,
we didn't
sure.
really
didn't
think
about
that.
One.
Not paying taxes to the syndicate. So this is
yeah.
like not passing cash up. You know, the fucking pyramid.
You got to shoot cash up the ladder.
You got to pay your bosses.
You know.
Stealing from them.
Yep.
Yep.
Not obeying orders.
Yeah, obviously. Yep.
Knowing too much, which
yeah.
is
See,
not
that's
necessarily...
An interesting one.
That's not necessarily like you've even stool-pigeoned at that point.
Yeah.
It's just like maybe you saw some shit,
you're
and
just
you're not
too much
trusted.
Of a liability, and they don't trust you enough.
Well, yeah,
to keep
there's a big score,
silence.
And it's like, you know, we don't even want to pay you. We just want
right.
to get rid of
and,
you.
And, you know, the crazy thing about that one is it might not even be something you did. You might have just been wrong place, wrong time, seen some shit you shouldn't have seen, and they're like, oh, we got to fucking take care of that loose end. Turning informant, obviously, yeah.
And, of course, the ultimate liability, which goes hand-in-hand with knowing too much, turning informant. The most brutal punishments were generally reserved for anyone thought to be known to even remotely consider speaking to the mob's activity to law enforcement. Rats, stool pigeons, snitches, or canaries, all unaffectionate and lethal terms to be branded with. Once labeled as such, the boys from the enforcement regime tagged you with another pair of names, Bum and Mark. Neither of those was good to have. Both meant you were probably going to die, and it would be a death that served a dual purpose. Particularly gory and torturous murders were used to both punish the mark and to send a very clear message to any and all others who were considering violating mob rule.
Yeah, because, you know, obviously, you know, if you're like, man, I think I might, you know, turn rat or whatever, and then you find, you know, like another guy fucking had his eyes gouged out and his tongue pulled out his asshole or something, and you're going to be like, never mind. I think I'm good. And obviously, you know...
Well, a threat's only as good as the action behind it. So they know if, like, if someone just makes a threat to you and it's like, at a certain point, you're going to go, okay, are they going to do anything or not?
Well,
if
it's
they
a
don't...
Different, it's a different kind of enforcement, kind of, right? Like TJ was talking about earlier, it's a smaller, more insular group. And so they don't have the... They don't have the numbers ability, you know? They can't show up with the tanks and the whole fucking SWAT team and shit and the helicopters and stuff. So really, they have to rely on another way of instilling fear, which is, hey, we could cut your fucking head off at any point.
Yeah, I mean, look, if you're a criminal as a living, if you're professionally a criminal, the biggest threat to your enterprise is always going to be people talking about what you do.
Right.
With law enforcement, because that's the biggest risk you run. That's the most likely way you're going to get caught. So you absolutely have to be brutal in the enforcement of no, you know, anybody. It has to be such an unappealing option for anybody that knows anything,
and even then, it still happens. And even with that, it still happens quite commonly because, like you said, now it's like, you know, a lot of like most killings in America are gang related,
right?
I mean,
to this day,
yeah, it's just a fact of life because, like you said, someone
for
comes
a lot
to your
of
territory.
These same reasons we're talking about.
Oh yeah.
Too. Knows too much.
Snitching. You know, snitching is like a thing.
Somebody might snitch, or somebody thinks that you did snitch. You were supposed to go deliver some drugs, and you spaced them off somewhere. You know what I mean? That type of shit will get you clipped, and it gets people clipped every fucking day to this day. But at this time, it was rather new. Organized crime was just starting to take hold in America.
So what time are we talking about exactly?
We're talking, well, when we're talking about Murder, Inc., you got to go back to like...
we're talking about like the 20s?
We're talking about, yeah, like the early 20s, the late teens of the 20th century.
So like a lot of mass immigration from Italy.
And you know, it didn't necessarily, wasn't born then, but the principles behind it were being cooked up then. I've got one more quick quote from Cipollini, and then we can move on.
Sure.
So he's talking about how these death warrants were issued. At first, the death sentences were issued carefully, albeit not entirely laden with solid evidence, but rarely without consideration, and certainly always with upper management sanction. Eliminating other gangland souls, undesirables who were willing participants in the underworld culture of lying, cheating, stealing, and of course, killing. The underworld carried out justice within its own microcosm, and all willing players of this seedy game knew the risks. So none of these guys could credibly claim to not know what was coming to them.
Oh, yeah.
So moving on to our first kind of look at one of the principal figures in Murder Incorporated. And I don't know what... This is, oh, this was just, you know, to show
this
a gangland killing.
So this is not, yeah, okay.
Right, and we can, you know, you can leave that up, but eventually we'll bring up a picture of Louis Lepke Buchalter.
I'll just bring him up. Oh, these are just some more killings.
Yeah, I thought you might want to cycle through it as we were talking, but I didn't. So, I forgot I pulled them anyway. It
doesn't matter. So here's this guy.
So this is Louis Lepke Buchalter.
Cool.
He was born in the Lower East Side section of Manhattan in February 1897.
Cool, another February baby.
Yep.
Just his, like me.
Hey, maybe you're like him in more ways than you think.
Cool, let's find out.
Rose Buchalter called him Lepkele, which is Little Louis in Yiddish, so he's a Jewish kid.
That's awesome. I've always had Jew envy, so...
Which later became Lepke. It was shortened and became his kind of mob name.
Sweet.
Louis Buchalter had one sister, three brothers. One brother eventually became a dentist. Another became a college professor and a rabbi.
So this guy comes from a family of obviously very intelligent people. I mean, this is obviously a pretty bright family.
It goes
of people,
on.
Because, I mean, like, you know, you're talking about these are all, like, yes, very prominent positions in the community and... You know,
I mean, look, dude.
Very educated positions.
Right. I mean, like, you don't, I mean, obviously, college
professor.
I mean,
he's Jewish, dude. What do you expect?
That's the top echelon of academia. Don't be Jew racist.
Yeah, don't be Jacist.
What I'm saying, guys, is like, look, everyone else's family, want to be a dentist, he's a dentist. He wanted to be a fucking great mobster. Look what he, look.
Check it out. His third brother was a pharmacist.
Yeah.
His father, Barnett Buchalter, was a Russian immigrant who operated his own hardware store on the Lower East Side.
So not as prestigious, but a business owner.
No, but a self-made businessman who managed to finance college for all of these children.
So that's obviously a very successful hardware store owner.
Now, because Louis was younger, the youngest, in fact, in 1909, unfortunately, when he was 12, his father died.
Damn.
In 1910, Buchalter finished elementary school and started a job selling theatrical goods, so like makeup and old clothes to use as stage props and stuff like that.
Okay.
Reportedly, on the Lower East Side, he attended the Rabbi Jacob Joseph School, where he was an honor roll student. Soon after, his mother moved to Arizona for health reasons, leaving Buchalter in the care of his sister, Sarah. However, Buchalter was quickly beyond her control.
Right. So there was, I'm assuming...
A broken family here.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
And also, it sounds like there was a little just bit of violence in his character at that time. And, you know...
yeah, his sister's trying, but, like, there's just...
She doesn't have the ability to actually keep him in line for whatever reason. He's just too headstrong. I mean, like, obviously, anyone who grows up to be a mobster... Yeah, has a sort of comfortableness with violence, probably at a young age,
right?
And it, you know, go. You could proceed because I see here we're going to
sure.
start talk about some
of
his.
Of course, yeah,
early
I got some specifics.
Doings.
Yeah, so his first run-in with the law was on September 2nd, 1915. He was arrested in New York for the first time for burglary and assault.
Mm-hmm.
The case was discharged for whatever reason.
Now, how old would he have been in 1915?
Well, we can do the math
18.
Here.
Okay, 18
Thank
years
you, Scotty,
old.
For having a fucking math brain.
Thank you for having that.
So he would have been what now?
18. He's born
okay.
in 1897, right?
Hold on, let me just double check
yeah,
that.
Yeah, let's check.
1897,
yep,
you're right.
That's right.
Yep. So, same year... in late 1915 or early 1916, I guess reports differ, Buchalter went to live with his uncle in Bridgeport, Connecticut.
Cool.
On February 29th, 1916, so he'd been 19 years old, he was arrested again in Bridgeport on the same type of charges, burglary. And he was sent to the Cheshire Reformatory for Juvenile Offenders in Cheshire, Connecticut. I guess at 19... you still were considered juvenile enough to not have to go to the big pokey back then.
Cool.
But I'm sure the juvenile reformatory was a hellhole.
Yeah, I'm sure it wasn't a paradise.
And it doesn't sound like it worked either because he was right back to crime.
So he was there until July 12th, 1917. After a dispute with his uncle over wages, Buchalter moved right back to New York City. On September 28th of that same year, 1917, Buchalter was sentenced in New York to 18 months in state prisons at Sing Sing, New York, on grand larceny conviction after a transfer to Auburn Prison in Auburn, New York. He was released on January 27th, 1919. On January 22nd, 1920, he returned to Sing Sing on a 30-month sentence for... yet another attempted burglary.
You know, I'm starting to think...
I mean, he's in his early 20s
at I'm starting
point.
To think he wasn't that great of a fucking burglar, you know?
I mean, look,
and it's hard
maybe
to
he pulled hundreds of jobs sheet. And he only got caught three times.
True.
Sure. I'm sure that's
Could
true.
Be.
Upon Buchalter's 1922 eventual release from prison, he started working with his childhood friend, mobster Jacob Gura Shapiro, and I pulled a picture
Shapiro,
of him.
Shapiro, huh?
Oh.
Yep. So this was actually, now this is an interesting thing that I knew a little bit about, but I learned a little bit more about doing this Murder, Inc. thing. The Jewish mob, or La Kosher Nostra, as it was called in some of the, some of the stuff I read. Right. Was actually very entwined with the Italian mob. They worked together on a lot of things. Now, not directly, but they helped one another out. They shared resources at times. And Lewis and his friend here, Jacob Shapiro, Gura, as he was known, were Jewish mobsters, basically, together.
Cool.
Through force and fear, they began gaining control of the garment industry union. So the garment industry in New York at that time was huge. Women worked in huge sweatshops making dresses and garments for men. And they started muscling in on that as a racket. You know, hey, we'll keep you safe, but, you know, it's going to cost 10% off the top every fucking week.
Of course.
And they were very violent. They didn't really like taking no for an answer. Buckalter's control of the unions evolved into a protection racket extending into areas such as bakery trucking. The unions were profitable for him, and he kept hold over them even after becoming an important figure in organized crime. Buckalter later formed an alliance with Tommy Lucchese. This is him here, leader of the Lucchese crime family. This was an Italian crime family, and together they controlled the entire garment district. So at that point, he's big shit. So he's got kind of a business tie with the Italian mafia. He's worked his way up as one of the strong arm guys in the Jewish mafia. So he's now become a powerful guy with a lot of money, a lot of influence. excuse me. I'm yakking a lot, so my throat is giving out. Let me give myself a little sip. All right. In the early 1930s, Buckalter created an effective process for performing contract killing for Cosa Nostra mobsters. It had no name, but the press 10 years later called it Murder Incorporated. The Cosa Nostra mobsters wanted to insulate themselves from any connection to these murders. Buckalter's partner, mobster Albert Anastasia, who we will talk a little more in detail about later, would relay a contract request from the Cosa Nostra to Buckalter. In turn, Buckalter would assign the job to Jewish and Italian street gang members in Brooklyn. So, and this is Albert Anastasia here, who is probably the most dapper mobster-looking dude I've ever seen. He had a few nicknames. We'll get to him later, but I'll just share his nicknames. One of his nicknames was the Lord High Executioner.
Cool.
Okay.
And his second nickname was the Mad Hatter.
Cool.
So
both of those are pretty awesome.
Cool guy. We'll talk about him later.
Oh, you think it's cool to murder people, huh, Paul?
No, I think he's
easily cool.
None of these contract killers had any connection with the major crime families. If they were caught, they could not implicate any of the crime family employers in the crimes. So it's like, it was like he was a middleman.
They made sure that there was like a few degrees of separation between them and any murder that happened.
So he collected around him this collection of street thugs, basically, that he knew he could trust to go kill somebody if he was willing to pay him enough. And then the mob used these guys didn't know the mobsters. They didn't know these guys' names. So even if the cops caught the dumbasses killing somebody.
Yeah, they're a contracted killer. They're basically subcontracting their killing is what you're saying.
Right. Exactly. So he takes a lot of the, you know, heat if one of these guys flips, but he was very adept at getting guys that were loyal, and one way he was adept at is he paid them a lot of fucking money. He charged between $5,000 and $10,000 for a hit, and this was in the 30s.
Right, so this is like,
now, he kept a significant portion of that, obviously, but you can imagine in the 30s, if you can look up a comparative, that
yeah, I'm looking up inflation right now.
If someone hands you $500 in the 30s, that's a ton of money.
So let's just say you do get a 10,000. Let's just say it's happening in 1935, right in the middle of the 30s,
mm-hmm.
And we're talking. Let's say you said between 5 and 10, so we'll
five
say
and ten.
Like 7,500.
And I saw numbers that were a little lower. No, it's not 100%. You know what I mean? Because this is all a shadowy fucking organization,
right? So this, you know, we don't know exact figure, but let's say you.
But it's estimated reason, between 5 and 10. That's
for
the
some
average.
Reason. There's a hit that's worth $7,500.
Right.
Dollars. That would be about $140,000.
I mean, so this is not chump change.
No.
Now, so you really got to want a motherfucker dead.
Once again.
To cough up that kind of money.
You got to imagine Buckalter and Albert Anastasia kept a significant portion of that.
Of course.
But they were probably able to hand these guys, you know, 5 or 10 grand in that you know, that time's money.
Right.
Whatever that would have been, you know what I mean? And that's fucking significant for these dudes, and it engendered a lot of loyalty in them. In 1935...
A $10,000 hit, by the way, yeah, just in case you're curious, would be about pretty close to $200,000 by today's money.
Wow. So that's, I mean, you can
about $186,000.
And the amount of money... Now, it is estimated... Now, the number of people that were killed by Murder Incorporated is another big contention.
Right, because obviously they specifically designed a system where they weren't, you know, going to be necessarily held culpable. So
some sources say it was in the range of 400 to 500 people, and some sources say it was well over 1,000. So if you imagine that those, now I'm sure that there were probably some people that were way low on the totem pole that weren't worth $5,000.
No, of course.
But you get my drift.
Right, those people, you know, whatever.
So in 35, Buckhalter and Anastasia arranged his most their most significant murder, the powerful New York gangster Dutch Schultz. And I think I pulled a picture of him as well. This is him.
Dutch Schultz.
Schultz had proposed the newly created National Crime Syndicate, a confederation of mobsters who, by the way, we could do an entire show on, and we very well may, that the New York District Attorney Thomas Dewey be murdered. So they wanted... Dutch Schultz kind of went nuts and decided that he wanted to fuck with the law.
Yeah, you don't really assassinate a district attorney. That's like, that's just begging for way more heat than your organization could possibly
handle. Not a great idea.
Many syndicate members hated Dewey already, but they denied Schultz's request outright. An enraged Dutch Schultz said he would kill Dewey anyway. This is, by the way, District Attorney Dewey. He said he would kill Dewey anyway and walked out of the meeting. The remaining attendees decided to murder Schultz instead and assigned the job to Buckhalter. On October 23rd, 1935, Schultz was shot and killed in a Newark, New Jersey tavern. In 1935, law enforcement estimated that Buckhalter and Shapiro had 250 men working for them. 250 fucking people whose sole job was to kill people.
Right.
And that Buckhalter was grossing over $1 million, which is $17 million in current dollar terms, per year. $17 million a year for killing people. They controlled rackets in the trucking, baking, and garment industries.
Yeah, I think that figure, I mean, might be a little outdated, because it says it's actually about $18.6 million.
Wow,
or actually closer to 18.7.
So almost
by today's
almost
standard,
19
by 2019.
Well, we
got to
figure too that tracking people down.
This is a huge murder industry we're talking.
I mean,
about.
At 250 people, there's a lot of support that goes in. Like, you have to find people that you're looking for. It's not like you can just fucking are they on Facebook now? It's like you have to actually physically find people in those times.
Right. Because if someone went into hiding, I mean, I'm sure plenty of people just because. It's hard to track, you know, just disappeared in the
sure, of course.
The gloaming or whatever the fuck.
So he owned a bunch of businesses. He also owned, I pulled a picture of this nightclub called the Rio Bamba. It doesn't exist anymore, but it was a really apparently hopping spot back in the day in New York. One of the most posh and upscale nightclubs that all the celebrities and...
Cool.
Hobnobbers. So he was this is legitimate money he's making.
Yes.
So he used...
They like to have the combination of legitimate businesses.
Of
and
well, this is the front. Of course, this and his other businesses were the front for all of his
your legitimate
money.
Cash flow.
Right.
Right, and you're laundering money through these places and all that kind
of
stuff. Of
course, the entire time.
So let's talk about that dapper gentleman from earlier, Albert Anastasia, the Lord High
let's
Executioner.
Do it. Oh, that cigarette looks so good.
And he looks good smoking it, too, doesn't he?
Man, I wish I had that cigarette.
And he, as you'll notice, he's got himself what looks to be like a little .32 caliber pistol kind of tucked in his arm there.
Yeah, I kind of see it, yeah.
He became a hitman and enforcer for Luciano and his associates and soon earned his nickname Lord High Executioner.
Cool.
So he was on the Italian mob side. These are some of the hits that Anastasia was tied to.
Dude, I love the card in his fucking hand.
Yeah, he was known. He had a flair to him. After Salvatore Maranzano and Joe Massaria were killed, Lucky Luciano formed the commission and appointed Vincent Mongiano as boss of the Gambino crime family. So this is kind of like the birth of what became the Gambino crime family of the modern era. Mangiano made Anastasia underboss in 1931 and head of his Brooklyn rackets. He soon became leader of Murder, Inc., along with Buchalter, who we talked about earlier. And Abe Relis became an enforcer. Charles Luciano used Murder, Inc. to enforce his authority. Joe Santora worked in a laundry, and when he didn't pay his tribute to Anastasia, he shot and killed Santora on August 2, 1933, and was suspected of murder. The witness changed his story in court and denied Anastasia killed him because he was frightened of his reputation.
Yeah.
Thomas Dewey, who closed down on organized crime and convicted Charles Luciano of prostitution, tried to convict Louis Buchalter of racketeering. Anastasia helped Buchalter hide in his Brooklyn neighborhood while that was going on. So this, you know, very much involved on the other end of this mob family, right? So the Jewish mafia and...
I feel like we need a fucking chart. We need like a diagram.
I know, there's a lot of names here. We're not going to cover all these guys. I'm just trying to give you an idea of the web.
Yeah, I mean, it sounds huge and intricate.
There's a very complex...
I can see why when you watch the movies about the dudes investigating right. these guys, they always have a fucking chart with all the fucking... This person is related to this, and this person's in charge
of
this.
It's all like... they're all based on like... It's like a giant extended fucking family.
It's a giant... And it's a giant extended corporate structure as well.
It is.
So, in response to his friend Buchalter being accused of racketeering, Anastasia helped his friend and personally... arranged the murder of 14 key witnesses and the secretary to Dewey.
Damn.
Who was the...
I hate to say it, but maybe they would have actually been better off assassinating Dewey.
Or not attorney general. Dewey was the fucking... What's the other... God damn it.
The attorney general?
Attorney.
District attorney.
District, thank you.
Yeah, DA.
I was just brain farting. So, Louis Buchalter was... actually convicted of racketeering and drugs by J. Edgar Hoover and was sentenced to 14 years in prison, which he served.
J. Edgar Hoover, piece of shit.
So I thought it would be cool after talking about, and we'll go back to him a little bit later, to Albert Anastasia and to Louis Buchalter, but I thought it would be cool to talk a little bit about where the entire operation was run out of, and you're taking a look at it here. This is one of the only pictures that I could find of the building where Murder Incorporated was run.
It's crazy to think that there's a multi-million dollar business
yeah.
being run out of this little...
A restaurant.
And it's actually not the entire building.
Right, there's
it's,
other stuff in there. There's right. a candy place in there. There's a chow mein joint.
It was the candy joint. It was called the Midnight Rose, and it was actually a candy and coffee shop that was open 24 hours.
Yep, and candy, soda, and cigars.
Yep. So... So during the 1930s and 40s, the Midnight Rose candy store, located under the elevated portion of the 3 subway train, was run by a little old lady in her 60s, Mrs. Rosie Gold. It's hard to imagine a more innocuous and unoffending picture, but it was all not as it seemed at the Midnight Rose, for this was the secret headquarters of the most infamous and deadly group in the history of organized crime, Murder Incorporated. So the guys would just basically hang there forever. She had a huge bank of telephones in the back for them to be in constant contact. And the guys would literally sit there sipping sodies.
Sody pop.
Smoking cigars and eating candies. And then when one of those phones would ring, one of the guys would, you know, whoever's the most hungry for them. And this is actually...
Here it is today, by the way.
This is the same building today. It's now a little mini mart. And I don't know what Stumpy's spot is.
Stumpy's!
Is that like an art gallery of drawings of TJ's weenie?
Oh, man. Brutal.
Stumpy's spot, dude.
What the fuck? What'd I do? I'm just sitting here.
I'm sorry, dude.
I'm being fucking nice and everything.
It was a micro penis joke. It had to come out. I'm sorry.
We'll see what else comes out.
So I just thought it was kind of funny that this entire giant, you know, like we said, $18, $19 million estimated, which you know, means
it's
was
like
probably
a corner,
more.
It's like a corner store.
Right.
Yeah.
Tiny little corner store, totally innocuous, little candy shop underneath a restaurant.
I mean, probably, no one would
not
ever
a place you'd really give a second glance, yeah, probably, nope. Unless you were in the mood for some candy or a cigar or something.
Nope. So it says here that the members of Murder Incorporated would pass the time at the Midnight Rose. They'd sip on the malts and until one of the phone rings giving the details of the hit, and then they'd go do it. And Rosie Gold was in on it. Of course, she knew what was going on. She was paid a healthy stipend. It's assumed she was never indicted in a crime for a crime or anything. But you got to imagine that the old lady that owned this candy shop that let all this happen there probably made out pretty well.
Oh yeah,
yep. You know, a little bit of yeah, I'm sure. So I mean, that's a good offer. You know, you're running this fucking little shitty candy shop. A bunch of mobsters are like, hey, we want to run a murder business out of your candy shop. Can we just like kind of. We'll give you like a lot of money, like way more than you make in the candy business. She's like, cool.
I just love that her evil old ass was over there and like, oh, you want to kill people and use my shop as a front for it? Sure.
Yeah.
Whatever.
I don't give
a fuck. I'm Rosie Gold.
Hey, I'm Rosie.
Business was a booming.
It was booming.
So we talked a little bit earlier about stool pigeons, didn't we?
Yep. And well, even with those tough guidelines in place, they still were able to flip.
The bird wants to sing.
Well, what you're looking at here is the man that ultimately led to the sinking of Murder Incorporated. This is Abe Kid Twist Rellis.
I'm assuming he's the dude in the middle.
Yep. Yes, that would be a good assumption.
The focal point of the picture.
The stoolie. The stool pigeon. The rat.
Goddamn rat bastard.
Throughout the 1930s, Rellis and his cohorts were able to eliminate local competition through assassination. So he was once one of the members of Murder, Inc. These included murders of the Shapiro brothers, who until their demise ran most of the Brooklyn bootlegging, slot, and vending machine rackets. One by one, each Shapiro brother was eliminated by execution. Meyer, the eldest, was found dead under the sands of Canarsie Beach, I think that's right, Canarsie Beach, in a sack, which he had been buried alive in.
Damn.
Others who met their demise were the Amberg brothers. This guy was one of the big players in Murder Incorporated.
They want to take over someone's territory, they just have them killed.
Right. He was one of the guys that was known for his brutality and, you know, his torturous killings. After attracting the attention of big-time gangsters like Lepke and our friend the Lord High Executioner, Rellis and his troop became the execution arm of what was known as the Syndicate, whose membership included at various times Lucky Luke Gianno, Meyer Lansky, Bugsy Siegel, Dutch Schultz, a lot of names that if you're at all into, you know, mafia stuff, you probably heard those names before, so at least some of them. And we very well may take a closer look at those guys in a future episode like this if you guys end up liking this one. The Syndicate would determine, often in mock trials with the gangsters acting as prosecutor, defense attorney, and judge, that someone needed to be eliminated for breaking underworld laws. So there was actually like a collection of these higher-ups in the Jewish and Italian mobs would get together, and they would have a mock trial. Where without the victim present, right, with no habeas corpus, where it's just like one of them plays defense attorney, one of them plays prosecutor, one of them plays judge, everybody else plays jury, and they decide, hey, are we going to clip this guy or not?
Well, I actually have a scene in the movie Casino where they do that, you know, where they all get indicted and like, and the guy's like, well, why take a chance?
There's,
you know,
also a scene like that in Analyze This.
Oh, really?
Yeah, that's true.
I've totally forgotten about that movie, and I kind of am mad that you reminded me.
You love Billy Crystal. TJ, you love Billy Crystal.
I like Billy Crystal.
You know what? I mean, I don't have no problem.
Pull up Analyze This,
hold
TJ.
On.
Pull up the poster for up. Analyze This.
Hold up now. I didn't say nothing bad about Billy fucking Crystal. Whatever.
Yeah, you did. You just pissed on one of his works. Yeah,
Analyze This, TJ.
All right, hold on.
Motherfucker, analyze my fucking fist in your fucking face, TJ.
Shut up. You don't know nothing. All right, hold on. I'm pulling it up. Hey, get out of here. I'm trying to pull something up here. Stupid fuck. There we go.
Yeah, there you go, dude. Look, how could you hate?
I don't know. It's even pixelated like it should be. I don't know. It wasn't funny, is all. And then they made
I thought it had its moments.
Did it?
Like, it was an interesting interaction, wasn't it? Wasn't it kind of an interesting interaction?
I don't remember
like to have
it being interesting.
This merciless mob boss who has this anxiety problem late in life goes to this like uptight, you know.
Hey, was that before or after The Sopranos? Because the mob boss with a fucking
I don't know, you'd have to look up. I think The Sopranos came out in like 92 or some shit, right? No, 96, 97.
Because they kind of stole from The Sopranos, if that's the case.
Or was it early 2000s? I don't fucking know.
Tony Soprano was the same guy. He's having panic attacks. It's like the same plot.
Yeah.
And then he's dealing with a therapist. I mean, that's basically they totally ripped off The Sopranos. Okay, so the first air date of this show was January 10th, 1999.
Okay.
And this movie also came out in 1999, so it's kind of unclear.
Oh, wow. Who ripped off who?
It might have just been two people with the similar idea at the same time.
Yeah.
So that does happen. Sometimes it's just in the zeitgeist. So that's kind of an interesting thing. I never even thought about that parallel, mostly because I don't think about this horrible movie.
Well, I never thought to place these two things together.
You got the great Robert De Niro. Billy Crystal.
I guess Paul never decided to analyze this.
Put Kid Twist back up on the screen here, TJ.
Do the twist.
So, and he was known for being really careful, never leaving a witness, but as time went on, he got sloppy.
What happened?
And in 1940, he was implicated in a number of killings.
So he got super sloppy.
Yep. Realizing that he was facing execution if convicted, he flipped and became a government witness.
But he knows he's going to suffer execution.
Well,
against the mob. He
probably believed the promises of these two gentlemen sitting next to him that he could be protected. He implicated his boss, our friend Lepke, in the murder of Brooklyn candy store owner Joseph Rosen. Apparently, there was some candy store beef.
Shit.
Hey,
I don't know exactly what went on.
I wonder if that was a special gift Rosie Gold? To Rosie.
Yeah, Rosie yeah. Gold's like, you know what?
I'm tired of Joseph Rosen stealing my business.
I bet it was, dude.
Take care of him.
Slit his fucking throat like the pig he is.
I mean, honestly, but think about it. She's hanging around a bunch of fucking killers all the time, and it's like, you know what? It's hurting our business here. Want us to go kill him for you?
You want we should kill him, Rosie?
Rosie, we'll kill him. We no problem. We'll go kill him right now.
But he didn't just sing on our friend Buchalter, or maybe not friend, but our the object of our examination.
Whatever,
earlier,
Paul,
Buchalter.
You've made your feelings
clear. Yeah, you're
clear.
Right. He's
friend,
my buddy.
The lovable scamp.
the lovable scamp.
Little fucking murderous bastard.
Yep. Tussle his non-existent hair.
He implicated a number of people at various levels in the organization and in a number of murders. I mean, he was about to burn the whole fucking thing down.
Yes.
All of these men that were implicated, so I'll give you a list of them just because what happened to them is fucking crazy and should show you how
just
angry the people would be.
Yeah, exactly why
so
they don't allow informants, basically.
He implicated Harry Pittsburgh Phil Strauss, Louis Capone, no relation. Mindy Weiss, Harry Happy Marione, Frank the Dasher Abbandando. And even Rellis' own childhood friend, Bugsy Goldstein.
Oh, man.
All of these men were convicted and executed for their crimes.
Damn.
So following these convictions, Rellis' next target was Albert Anastasia, the High Lord Executioner himself, who had been the co-chief of operations of Murder, Inc. Rellis was to implicate Anastasia on the murder of a Union longshoreman, Pete Panto. However, unlike other members of Murder, Inc., Anastasia was a high-ranking member of the Cosa Nostra. The trial, based solely on Rellis' testimony, was set for November 12, 1941.
Set for?
Yeah.
Sounds like it didn't happen.
A little foreshadowing. Until then, Rellis was under constant guard by six police detectives at the Half Moon Hotel on Coney Island.
Mm.
To protect the New York crime families from exposure, boss Frank Costello reportedly raised $100,000 to bribe these guards.
$100,000 in 1941
Damn.
Money. So yep. I'm going to set 1941 in our calculator. And you said how much?
$100,000.
$100,000.
That's insane, dude.
How do you think he went?
Oh, shit.
I'm guessing they probably made it look like he killed himself or something like that.
That is $1.7 million by today's standards. So there's a $1.7 million hit on this guy's fucking head at that point.
Right. So remember, he's, under constant guard on a high floor
cops.
In the Half Moon Hotel on Coney Island. He's got six guards. Reportedly, Frank Costello has raised $100,000 to bribe these guards to off Rellis.
So they got him. So he's basically paying the guard. They're going to make it look like an accident for sure. So do they fake a suicide or something? Or
does he jump?
Well,
maybe?
In the early morning of November 12th, 1941, unfortunately, our friend Abe Relis fell to his death from a window at the Half Moon Hotel on Coney Island. Though he will be missed, Marona me.
Bye, Abe.
Why, in the flower of his youth? It's not known whether he was thrown or pushed out the window or if he was trying to escape.
I don't think it was that one.
Right.
I'm pretty sure it was.
Yeah.
I don't know what the big difference is between thrown or pushed, right. But it was probably one of those.
Yeah, I'm going to go with one of those.
I'm going to go with thrown or pushed.
I don't think he was so distraught that he was trying to escape from a high window.
But surprisingly enough, the 1951 grand jury concluded that it was an accidental death. But
well, yeah, because the police were involved at that point, so they don't want to fucking make them look
bad. I don't
bad.
Know what to tell you. D.A., he just slipped and tripped and fell out the fucking window.
Yeah, even though there was six of us here, you know, he just fell. I don't know.
I mean, what are we supposed to do? 20 years later, an ailing Lucky Luciano, one of the chief founders of the National Crime Syndicate in the early 1930s, insisted that Frank Costello had set up Relis' demise and that $50,000 had been distributed to the police department to have Relis flipped out the window.
I don't buy it.
What?
I don't believe it.
No way.
And that's a little picture of Lucky.
Aw.
But as you can imagine, after 10 years of tyranny and upwards of 1,000 body bags by some accounts, Murder Incorporated had come to an end. And one
too
of those
hot, too much heat.
Remember, one of those names that I mentioned that our friend the stool pigeon implicated was Lepke Buchalter. And I've got a newsreel here about his execution.
Damn. Fuck you, Getty Images.
The electric chair ends the career of gangster Louis Lepke Buchalter, boss of Brooklyn Murder Incorporated. Lepke and Sing Sing's death house appealed to Governor Dewey and to the United States Supreme Court in vain. Wanted for 80 murders, he died for one committed in 1936. Once public enemy number one, Boss Lepke was a cringing, frightened man as he began his last ride. Thus, an era of wholesale gang murder comes to an end. An era of hijacking, labor racketeering, and Tommy guns.
I'm so glad that's all over with.
Yeah.
And Tommy guns.
That part's over, but only because we have better weapons now.
Yeah.
Although the Tommy gun, that was a fucking cool-looking gun, man.
Lepke's prosecutor, Assistant District Attorney Burton Turkus, closes the...
Burton Turkus? What?
Case.
With the international gangsters still to be brought to justice, a process that will cost...
Why was there ever a period in time where that mustache was considered a trustworthy mustache to have?
This time.
I guess. But why? You know, because like he clearly just looks like a rat bastard scumfuck.
The lives of countless thousands of innocent persons, the passing of Lepke is of comparatively little significance.
Okay.
So there you go.
I'm glad that you've been imbued with the ability to make that determination.
And, yeah, well, that mustache gives him the power to proclaim only truths out of his mouth. It's the mustachio of truth.
Mustachio of truth. I will tell you whose life matters.
Yes.
Good you know for what, you. I think that might be a good look for you, man.
Yeah, you should try the mustache of
the
truth.
The pencil mustache.
You already did the
kind
of shaved your head thing. You could just do the pencil mustache.
Yeah.
Do the mustache of truth,
mustachio.
TJ. So that no more fucking lies will flow forth from your mouth. Only truths. So this is Vito Genovese.
Vito!
And we got one more guy that we talked about that's still alive at the end of this.
Anastasia.
And still walking around. Yeah, Albert Anastasia is still around, still looking dapper. But his problem is right here on the screen. This is Vito Genovese.
Piece of shit.
He wanted to become the crime boss. The only thing standing in his way was Frank Costello, who was currently the crime boss. And to take out Costello... he needed to take out Anastasia, who was the underboss and loyal to Costello. So he sought approval from Meyer Lansky, who was acting as the boss while Lucky Luciano was in jail and running kind of the business end for it. Genovese also offered Carlo Gambino the chance to run the Anastasia family if he supported him in taking out Costello and Anastasia. So... he basically,
a lot of drama between these guys.
Oh, yeah.
They're always...
But though, I mean, you some
jockeying
of those
for position. And
some
shit.
Of those names should ring in your head, Gambino.
Yeah, of course.
Right.
Yeah,
so this was, you know, he engineered the modern mafia basically with this overthrowing of the old guard in Frank Costello and Albert Anastasia. So there was a botched attempt on Frank Costello's life, but he survived it. In May 1957, he stepped down as boss. So
he's like, fuck this.
He saw the writing on the wall, and he was like, fuck you guys, whatever, I'll walk away, you can have it.
Yeah, it's like, all right, I don't really want to be killed. I feel like I've done what I need to do.
Yeah, he got lucky once is enough.
I'm peacing out, see
but
ya.
But that makes Albert Anastasia the boss. He steps into the shoes. So he's, of course, next on the list. So here's the setting, okay, for how Anastasia went out. And here's the hotel. He's
an ominous looking building, if I do say so myself.
He's sitting in a barber's chair at this hotel, the Park Sheridan Hotel on 877th Avenue, which is now renamed the Park Central Hotel. And it's been kind of mooched over to 56th and 7th. Strangely, as he's standing there getting a shave, his bodyguard took a walk. Now, whether Anastasia knew this was going to happen or not is unclear.
So his bodyguard is just like, I'm gonna take a little fucking hike down the street, basically.
Or just, you know, this is a huge hotel. It had a huge shopping area. So he's, you know, maybe he just, I'm going to take a leak. Nobody knows.
You probably feel like in a big-ass hotel that's surely full of people that, you know, you're pretty safe. No one's going to fucking...
One would assume.
Right.
You know, raid somewhere with that many witnesses and all that shit, but apparently it wasn't a factor.
And it's unknown to this day whether the bodyguard was in on the hit or whether he genuinely just had to go take a shit or wanted to go shopping for his wife or what. But out of nowhere, two men rushed into the shop in scarves and just unleashed a tirade of bullets at Anastasia as he sat there in the barber chair. Now, some documentaries have said that the shots were knocked him out of his chair, but this is not true. Anastasia actually got up out of the chair and charged at the men. This is fucked up, but actually kind of cool and would make a really cool scene in a movie.
Yeah.
But
his last fucking... With his last bit of life, he tries to fucking seek revenge for his own murder.
But in that moment of panic and confusion, what he was looking at was the reflection of the men in the barber's mirror.
So he basically just charged the mirror.
And he charged the mirror. They continued shooting, and he fell dead. I've actually got a couple of pictures of the murder scene here. No one was ever charged with the murder. And a New York journalist was reported to say the vivid image of a helpless victim swathed in white towels was stamped into public memory. And that was about the kindest thing I could find in any of the obituaries for Albert Anastasia.
Yeah, but, I mean, obviously, most people are not going to be effusive with praise when a mob boss gets shot.
No, of course
not. They're not going to be like, he was a great man and all that, you know.
But that is how Murder Incorporated finally met its end.
But it wasn't the end of the mob murdering people.
No, absolutely not. But there was never a coalition like that again within the mob. Hits were done differently after this. There was never a giant organization where the mob could go to.
There was never a murder department anymore. You know, basically.
I mean, not like this.
Not like that one.
Not like this.
And maybe we can learn about how it evolved. In another episode.
Yeah, I'd really like to take a look at some of the bosses of these different crime families. Doing an entire episode on the five families, of New York, I think would be really cool. Or maybe even breaking it up.
Well, who knows?
The modern conception really now more is if it's either someone that's trying to make an upstart, like we said, we saw there, or it's, you know, the boss is like, you disrespect him, you did something I didn't like, something have you killed.
Right.
Or I'm going to kill you personally.
Right. So... I had a lot of fun pulling for this episode, actually. I like learning about these guys. So if you guys like it, tell us down in the comments. Also, click on the t-shirt link down in the comments and get our new demonetized t-shirt.
I'll show you that one more time.
That's not it there. That's a dead mobster. But this is almost... Actually, this is cooler than a dead mobster. This is our new demonetized t-shirt where we fight the evil Scotty. Yes, the Wojcicapus. I love the screaming mad anger in my face and my battle ball. Look at Scotty deflecting one of her hideous, purple beams.
Look, TJ, you're about ready to fucking swing that axe cleaver in
yeah.
two.
And TJ,
look
with
at
his,
my gritted teeth, dude.
Yeah, your gritted teeth and your muscle rolls just
yeah.
bulging and ready to fucking.
I mean, my ass looks nicer than that, actually. But,
oh,
you know.
And you know what? I didn't even notice. Look at the Wojcicka puss's earring.
Yep, it's a YouTube. It's a YouTube.
This is a badass. Show them the shirts again, TJ. Show them the different colors.
Sure
real
will.
Quick.
So you can get this one.
Yeah, we got awesome. We got awesome colors.
You can get this one. You can get this one. You can get this one. There's all kinds of pretty colors. Look at them all.
I think I'm going to get that pink one, honestly.
You think you can go for the pink?
Pink or the green? Oh, God, I like that blue, too, though.
I think I'm going to do
the
blue.
Baby blue.
Okay, I'm not going to copy TJ, then. I'm going to go with the green.
Well, I might do the darker blue. No, I'm going to do the lighter blue.
Yeah, the lighter blue is cool. Well, you can get it now. Go click on the link down below. Also, check out Spooky Lolly, who's the talented artist behind the new T-shirt.
Yes.
Go give him some love on Twitter. Thank you guys for watching.
Go suck his dick.
Don't become a mobster, but appreciate the people who do.
And most importantly, you know, just don't fall for the idea that this is like monsters or some shit. I hate the pseudo-speciation that happens when you're dealing about, you know, murderers and cutthroats.
We've talked about it before.
And, you know, we've talked about it with the serial killers, you know, but, like, these guys, at the end of the day, I mean, obviously what they're doing is bad and all that shit.
There's no justifying that, what
yeah,
they've done.
You know, they're businessmen.
But they were human beings.
And, you know, honestly, corporate America does things that kill people. We
oh,
all know
absolutely.
They do it. You know, these people, these guys are really no worse at the end of the day, to in my mind, than fucking Walmart or Amazon or anything.
Just
any
a little more direct.
Shit. Yeah, just a little bit more blood directly on their hands is the main difference. They don't have the same level of degrees of separation because they're not doing it, you know, on that fucking level where you're totally insulated
they're,
from
they're
it.
They're doing it, you know. I mean,
think about the fucking tobacco
industry.
The
core
here,
of
for
it,
fuck's
the
sake.
Core of it is exploitation,
right?
Yeah,
and it's just the means of exploitation, and one is acknowledged and allowed and actually praised by society, and one is shit upon and you know and is demonized,
right? And you know, if you really want to stop shit like that from happening. Then maybe don't fucking push industries like the drug industry into the fucking underground. I mean, obviously some things have to be illegal, but
you ready?
There's a lot of stuff that doesn't need to be.
Sorry, TJ.
Oh, shit.
This is just business.
Oh, God, no. 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 Ah! Beat this motherfucker down! Ah! Beat this motherfucker down!